Here's a story. Coyote is going along when a couple of humans are too. Then Coyote gets picked up in the grill of their truck, just like a bug. He's caught there and undiscovered until they reach California hundreds of miles later. Miraculously, Coyote survives, escaping the ordeal with just a couple of cuts. While this isn't how all the coyotes ranging across North America dispersed, it's certainly characteristic of the kind of punches these animals can roll with, and one of the many true stories shared in Coyote America, a new book about how two unlikely predators have colonized this continent together, even when extreme odds with one another. It's the 10th book on the Western United States penned by our guest today. Among his other works are American Serengeti, The Last Big Animals of the Plains, and The Natural West, Environmental History in the Great Plains and Rocky Mountains. He's an award-winning historian and a professor emeritus at the University of Montana. He now lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Dan Flores, welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, it's a great delight to be with you. Thank you.
The feeling is certainly mutual. I very much enjoyed reviewing your book, Coyote America, and it got me thinking about how common it is, actually, relatively speaking, to see coyotes, perhaps the most common large wildlife encounter there is in this country. Could you tell us about an encounter you've had with a coyote that really shored up your resolve to write a book like this?
Well, I've lived in the West most of my adult life. I grew up in Louisiana, and interestingly enough, my first coyote experiences were actually there. In the West, in New Mexico and Montana, I've had coyotes in the yard and around me all the time. But in Louisiana, when I was a kid, at the age of about 14 years old, I encountered an animal that absolutely perplexed me. As I say in the book, it was a little bit like rounding a corner in New Orleans and coming face to face with a moose. and this animal, it turned out, was probably a coyote-red wolf hybrid. And this was at a time in the early 1960s when coyotes were colonizing out of the West and beginning to spread across the South and East. And I think that encounter at the age of 14 pretty much set me on the road to ultimately writing a book about what I really think is probably the most fascinating native North American animal out there.
And is this when you saw a coyote carrying what appeared to be a six-pack, or when you saw a red wolf that actually came when you sounded a predator call?
Yeah, the story I just related was when I was 14 and I had a local hardware store owner tout me on buying this predator call that had just come on the market, and I had seen a fox run over on a highway, and I thought I could take it out into the woods, this call, and lure in a fox. But what I got instead was this animal that was several times larger than a fox, looked like it was walking on stilts. And it sent me, in fact, home to write a letter to Louisiana Parks and Wildlife to ask them whether there were wolves in Caddo Parish and the area where I grew up.
And what did they write back?
Well, they wrote back that I could possibly have seen a wolf, that they thought that there were a few red wolves left in that part of the state, but that more likely what I had seen was either a coyote or a coyote-red wolf hybrid. And just the use of the word coyote in Louisiana in the 1960s was, I mean, that was a complete shock. I had been sort of trained by watching Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color and by watching the Coyote Roadrunner cartoons to think of coyotes as purely these animals of the slick rock, red western deserts. And suddenly, here along the Black Bayou in Louisiana, coyotes were showing up. And it seemed to be, even to a 14-year-old, kind of a remarkable thing, because I knew my family went back in Louisiana for hundreds of years, and no one had ever told me a coyote story before. So this seemed to be something that was happening that was brand new in the world.
And many, many years later, you go on to write this biography of coyotes, Coyote America, a natural and a supernatural history.
Yeah.
When did this little desert dog start, foraging in places like Louisiana?
Well, it seems to have happened largely in the middle of the 20th century. There are some reports of of coyotes showing up in places like upstate New York, just across from the Canadian border, as early as the 1920s. But what appeared to set them in motion, I argue, were a couple of things that were happening in 20th century America. One of them was the near extirpation of wolves in the South and in the East, which created this new canid opportunity coyotes are basically small wolves, and so they saw that as an opportunity to colonize new territory where wolves had disappeared. But another thing that happened in these same years was that the United States government and state governments all across the West had been engaged in this war of extermination against them, and It set in motion a series of evolutionary adaptations that coyotes had developed basically by living for many thousands of years in North America alongside wolves. And wolves, as the big dogs, had sort of persecuted them and hounded them. And so they developed this ability to rebound their populations really quickly. And when they're pressured, they tend to disperse and scatter. And so when we began to do that in the mid-20s, after wolves in the West were pretty much taken care of, we decided that coyotes were the arch predator in North America. And so this war of extermination really sort of set them in motion in terms of colonizing. And suddenly, within a decade or two, coyotes were all over the continent.
It is in many ways a comedy of consequences here, as coyotes have risen despite our best attempts to exterminate them throughout the last century. Our guest is very knowledgeable on this subject. It's Dan Flores, award-winning historian and writer of the new book, Coyote America. We'll be back on The Exchange with many more questions for Dan, and hopefully your phone calls and emails. Phone number and email address coming up after a very short break. On the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan, and we're talking with Dan Flores. His new book is Coyote America. There's a lot of stories in it, a lot of sayings about coyotes, or coyotes, as you might see them. One of them is, the only thing smarter than a coyote is God. In which case, gods were strung up by their hind legs on the country fence post where I grew up. What is your experience with coyotes? Do you see them as icons, as pests? Do they menace your property, eat your dogs, your livestock? Or do you love and respect the little desert guys? Give us a call, 800-838-3760, or jx@jeffnet.org. Dan, you were just talking about these two really important factors for coyotes in the last century. I kind of want to wind us back a little bit further than that in your biography to the role of coyotes on this continent before white settlement and European expansionism, and how other cultures saw them.
Sure. Well, coyotes are, as a species, out of the canid family, which is a purely North American evolved family from 5.3 million years ago, but they emerged as a distinctive species about a million years ago, so they're a fairly recent species out of the canid line. And of course, they only encountered human beings, we think, probably as far back as about 15,000 years ago, when people began to colonize North America out of Asia. And one of the really interesting things that happened early on in this relationship between people and coyotes is that in the aftermath of the great Pleistocene extinctions, which occurred roughly 10,000 years ago and took out many, many species across North America, mammoths and ground sloths and saber-toothed cats and steppe lions and on and on and on, the animal that native people in the West seem to resolve on as kind of emblematic of themselves and as worthy of a semi-deity status was the survivor of the Pleistocene extinctions, or one of those survivors, which was this little small canid, the coyote. And so they they basically made it into the first version of what I argue in the book is many kinds of human avatars, of kind of stand-in figures in the natural world for human beings. And so out of that came this, what I think is probably the oldest North American literary canon, which are these stories of coyotes that go back 10,000 years, hundreds of them, all with the idea, it seems to me, I mean, we thought of them as basically trickster stories, but it seems to me when I reread many of them for working on this book that what they're really all about is teaching us about human nature, so that coyote kind of functions as this coyote man, this avatar figure who he conveys all of the best traits and the worst traits of humanity. And the stories are designed to illustrate those with probably the ultimate function of teaching proper behavior.
A contradictory beast, it sounds like. I can certainly relate to that. I want to take a call now. We've got Mark in Grants Pass on the line with a question in this vein. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I've done some extensive work with Mark Tveskov. He's one of the archaeologists there at SOU.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my studies has been for the last several years that the Kelma creator image as the dragonfly. In fact, it's twin brothers. I was wondering, in the coyote motif mythology, does it ever occur where the coyote pairs off his brothers?
There are stories, and thanks for that question, Mark. There are stories that pretty much cover the gamut. I mean, coyote is, in the stories of some native peoples, he's paired with other beings, the fox, the hare. I mean, in a sort of a, not an exact mirror, but reminiscent of Aesop's tales from Europe, the coyote sometimes appears with a cadre of associates. In some of them, some of the stories from other people, though, he's a single figure, and what he often seems to function as is he's the special helper of the ultimate cause God. The ultimate cause God doesn't seem to have much interest in actually manipulating the world, and so that's Coyote's task. And he goes about that task with a great deal of joy of life, of passion, of sensuous passion, and he really enjoys interacting with human beings.
If you're just joining us, Dan Flores is our guest. He's the author of Coyote America, a natural and supernatural history of this iconic animal in the American West. You can join the discussion 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dan, fast forwarding again to, it sounds like coyotes were relatively respected, even revered for centuries on this continent. And then a different culture, different cultures begin to dominate with colonization. How does the coyote fare during, say, the boom of the fur trade?
Coyotes, it did indeed go for many thousands of years being unmolested, unharmed, observed very carefully and respected and seen as sort of the earthly personifications of the semi-deity figure. But when Europeans arrive, I mean, interesting things happen because Europeans come over with existing folktales about bears, about wolves, about a large number of animals. But, of course, the coyote is a brand new species they've never seen before. I mean, for one thing, they don't know what to call it. And the initial encounter with coyotes in the West by Europeans who are literary and who basically publish their findings is by Lewis and Clark, and they give it the name prairie wolf, which it's the name that coyotes basically have in most of English-speaking America for the next 100 years or so. The name is only gets replaced by coyote towards the end of the 19th century. But essentially, Americans at first don't really know exactly what to think of them, and so we go for a lot of the 19th century without any really either positive or negative values associated with coyotes, until it turns out that they are valuable for their fur. And in a good bit of the 19th century, really from about the 1840s to the 1880s or so, coyotes function as a target of fur hunters in the West, and they're common enough, in fact, that their hides actually began to circulate as currency. They're worth $1, and they're often exchanged between traders instead of money, just as currency. But that's kind of the first time that European Americans decide that coyotes have some function in the world, and at in the beginning it's as a fur-bearing animal.
And then it strikes me, reading your book, Coyote America, you could almost frame American history by the methods that we use to kill coyotes in each different decade or era. Would you agree with that, or could you run with that that framework at all?
Yeah, you know, what I think happened, and I certainly give this very famous American writer his due, but Mark Twain in Roughing It is the one who, the person whose words have a long reach, for one thing, and he gives us a way to think about coyotes, finally. The book is published in the 1870s, and at that point, Twain's sort of verdict on them, that they're this sort of despicable, slinking little beast. He says in his description that they live in the worst habitats imaginable, out in the barest deserts. They basically live on carrion, and he says they're so despicable, in fact, that any self-respecting flea on the back of a coyote, if it sees a centipede or a velocipede, it'll abandon the coyote for the insect. So, I mean, you know, Mark Twain, as he warms to the task, and he goes on for about three or four pages in this vein, I mean, the story just gets more and more outrageous. And by the time that book had been read by a large majority of the reading public in the United States, suddenly people thought they knew what to think. And from that point on, the idea is that the only function this animal has is as live target practice. It's really not worth the ammunition that's required to shoot them, but you should go ahead and shoot them because it's a patriotic duty. We need to get rid of them. And I mean, this just goes right seamlessly right into the 20th century, when suddenly, of course, we have this government agency, the Bureau of Biological Survey, that decides that the only way it can stay going and get funding from Congress is to address the issue of predators in the West. And that agency decides that wolves and coyotes' days are numbered, that they're going to be responsible for basically winking them out.
I'm guessing that this has some ecological consequences. I think Anne and Eugene may have a question to this effect. She's been waiting on the line. Anne, welcome to the exchange. Anne, are you with us? Oh, and let's go to Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the exchange.
Thank you. I've known about coyotes and have watched them and this sort of thing. And mainly what they do is help ranchers and farmers by eating rodents, and you know, and of course, anybody that gets rid of carrion is actually doing a good thing. And so, it seems to me that your explanation that a government agency wanted to find a task in order to keep its funding makes a lot of sense of why there was this horrible poisoning that had, you know, awful ecological effects, and why the coyote still has a bad reputation. I think about the only ranch animal it could do any damage to are lambs, and we're not raising all that many sheep anymore. So thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you said it very well, and that's you sort of tracked my arguments about a lot of the 20th century. I mean, we engage in this this destruction and attempted annihilation of these animals, for one thing, without any science to go on whatsoever. And in there, it emerges by the 1920s that there are episodes where it's clear that in places where coyotes have been thinned, you begin to have bumper crops of rats and mice and jackrabbits. And so we start getting these anecdotal accounts from around the West as early as the 1920s. But the Bureau of Biological Survey has no science whatsoever. And when they do get around to sending scientists out with the task specifically of demonstrating that coyotes are the arch predator of our time, as the Bureau puts it, with wolves now almost gone, they turn their full attention to coyotes. When these biologists go out in places like Yellowstone and Jackson Hole, and I'm particularly thinking of the studies done by the famous Murray brothers, Adolf and Olaus Murray, what they discover is what we, of course, know now as a result of ecological science, that coyotes basically eat rats and mice and rabbits, and they're really animals that serve, as Adolf Murray said, 80% of what they do is beneficial to humans. But interestingly enough, when those studies went back to the Murray brothers' superiors in the Park Service and at the Bureau of Biological Survey, they just ignored them. The Park Service went ahead and stopped actively killing coyotes by about 1940 in the wake of Adolf Murray's report, but the Biological Survey just continued. I mean, in fact, it had gotten sanction from the Animal Damage Control Act of 1931 and a budget of $10 million to exterminate coyotes, and so it used the World War II period to invent a whole new host of poisons to try to push that program to its ultimate end, only to be foiled by the fact that coyotes simply were incapable of being exterminated.
Let's take another call. We've got Deirdre in Ashland on the line. Deirdre, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, so I just wanted to bring a little bit of balance to it. I live on some acreage outside of Ashland and have chickens with my son and his wife, and we've lost probably 20 chickens in the past 6 months because we attempted free range, and free range means that coyotes will eat them.
So coyotes, not so good for your operation. Have you...
You know, I don't believe in exterminating them by any stretch.
So what kind of control methods are you using?
Well, now we're using fencing.
Yeah.
And previously, they were really, truly free range. Well, there was an outside fence, but it was easily permeated by the coyote.
All right. Deirdre, thank you so much for sharing your experience. So, Dan, I mean, you said a minute ago, you know, coyotes actually are good for our ecology in a lot of ways. In your book, you describe the roads being slicked with rodents in areas where coyotes were briefly eradicated. But what about the people who see them as coyotes, whose livelihoods are jeopardized by having another predator around?
Well, I mean, there's no question that Deirdre's point is a good one. There are people who lose chickens. It's the United States sheep industry that is the largest active proponent of continued coyote control. And the successor to the Biological Survey, which is now called Wildlife Services, continues to answer that need. They, on behalf of the sheep industry and of agricultural producers, they basically kill about 80,000 coyotes a year.
Still.
Still today. Yeah, between 2005 and 2011, they retired, as they called it, 512,000 coyotes in the West, mostly doing it with traps, and they still have one poison available to them, the M44, which shoots a cyanide mist into a coyote's face. But they primarily do it with airplanes, helicopters. I mean, they use big technology to go after these animals.
Well, I want to talk more about the Wildlife Service's policies coming ahead on the other side of our break. Before we get there, though, when in history did coyote extermination become controversial? When did, you know, Mark Twain's perspective and this idea that they just need to be wiped off the face of the earth become something that people raised an eyebrow at?
Well, it goes back to opposition to extermination. It goes back to the Society of American Mammalogists in the 1920s. People like Aldo Leopold, for example, who had started out their careers being in favor of the control or extermination of predators. And then as they began to do research into things like predator-prey balances, the balance of nature, the role of ecological niches, they began to realize that this was a really short-sighted way of doing things, and so they started trying to do studies. So the first opposition actually comes from scientists in the biological community in the 1920s and 1930s. And then in the 50s and 60s, as we can talk about, American pop culture kind of comes into the game in a very interesting way.
Right, of course. Coyote is portrayed very sympathetically in some of Disney's productions. We've got a sample of that actually coming up on the other side of this break, a little piece of something from Coyote's Lament. If you're just joining us, we've been talking with Dan Flores. He's the author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. He's a writer and historian of the American West. His writing has appeared in the High Country News, among many other publications, and 9 other books. He is a retired professor from the University of Montana, now lives in Santa Fe, and joins us this morning for about 15 more minutes. Hope you'll join this discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange with me, your host, Emily Curitan. Phone number and email address are on the way on the other side of this very short break.
Yip, yip, yip. Meow.
Yip, yip, yip,
yes,
yow.
Listen, there it
is. Oh, we once had a home where we just loved to roam and hunt rabbits and squirrels all day. Then man moved west.
Of course, this is cut from Disney's Coyote's Lament. Our guest today, Dan Flores, seems to remember it well. He's the author of Coyote America. We're talking about the history of that animal on this continent. Join our discussion, 800-838-3760, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dan, did we strike a nostalgic chord there with you?
You absolutely did. As I relate in the book, I was a rapt observer and listener of that film when it first aired in 1962, and that brings back a lot of memories. Of course, when I was working on the book, I got to listen to it a couple more times and watch the film. I mean, it's an hour long, and it's remarkable. I have to say, I got to give it to Walt Disney for doing something like that. I think he helped pop culture change the way a lot of people in the 1960s and 70s thought about coyotes.
And culture was changing at this time. In your book, Coyote America, you also write about the influence of Rachel Carson and the rise of the environmental movement. Where did coyotes figure into sort of the changing public image of ecology and of predators?
Well, Rachel Carson, of course, deserves a huge amount of credit in history for making America aware of the rampant use of poisons that had been underway for really several decades against gypsy moths, against mosquitoes, against, it turned out, coyotes as well. And so one of the animals, I mean, her focus, of course, in Silent Spring is on birds and the secondary effects of poisoning that lead to thinned eggshells and the demise of songbirds. But one of the animals that became quite well known in the 1960s that was also being poisoned in huge numbers were coyotes. I mean, there were articles in magazines like Outdoor Life, for example, that were often read by kind of the hunting and fishing contingent that really were exposés of the extraordinary number of poison baits that were being scattered across the western landscape to kill coyotes.
But then Nixon bans poisoning of coyotes in at least the government campaigns. Isn't that right? And we switch to tactics to more gunning or finding them in their dens, that kind of a thing?
That's right. And it's, I think it's a surprise to most people to realize that it was Richard Nixon who, by presidential proclamation in 1972, ban the use of poisons to kill coyotes on the public lands. Nixon did it largely because he hoped to crest the wave of the environmental movement. He thought this might be a way to win over some of the people of the ecology generation to the side of his administration. And really, when he discovered that that was not going to work, that Vietnam was too big a hurdle for people of the 60s and 70s, the young people especially, to embrace some of the, and in fact, very important environmental bills that he got passed, he basically abandoned environmentalism. And that, in turn, led, as you suggested, to the agency that was about to become Wildlife Services to decide that the way to control them in the future was still using mortality methods, but to aerial gun them with planes and helicopters. And so that's the next step in this campaign.
We just had a caller on the line who dropped off, and he wrote in to say he had over 100,000 sheep when his family moved here 65 years ago, and coyotes are the only reason that they don't have them today. Banning poison was the tipping point there. I mean, you must come up against this over and over. You write of, you know, actually having a pretty cold reception in, say, Nebraska. I'm from Texas. I know that some of coyote sympathy is not well received there. It seems to me at the heart of it, your argument, though, is that these methods don't work anyway. Even if you get in a helicopter and have a romping good time mowing down a bunch of coyotes, you don't really have much of an impact on their population. Would Wildlife Services argue otherwise?
You know, I interviewed the people at the Science Methods Lab for Wildlife Services, spent an afternoon with them, talking to them about this issue, because they know, as well as people in the biological sciences know, that back in the late 1960s, a study that has been done several times now using computer modeling indicated that under pressure, because of these adaptations to increase their populations and to colonize that coyotes have, in effect, you can kill 75% of the population of coyotes in a given area in 1 year, and the next year their population is exactly back up to the level you started with. You can do this for 50 years in a row, and you still do not reduce their population. So what the Wildlife Services people told me is basically they continue killing coyotes primarily because the livestock industry wants them to do something. And what a lot of activists on the outside of this campaign argue is that they understand that people in agricultural settings, especially sheep raisers, need something to help them cope with coyotes that sometimes can indeed attack sheep, but what they're pushing for are non-lethal controls rather than killing these animals in what seems to be an act of ideology, because it never works. It's just going to go on and on and on, and it will never stop, and it will never reduce the number of animals.
We're talking with Dan Flores, if you're just joining us. His new book is Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History of That Animal. You can join the discussion. A few minutes left here, 800-838-3760, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dan, we've got Steve in Eugene on the line. Steve's waited very patiently. Steve, welcome to the program.
Howdy.
Hi.
Just wondering, how successful have we been, if at all, in domesticating the coyote, and do we know why?
Oh, that's a really great question, and so thanks for it, Steve. You know, we've got some interesting speculations now about animal domestication to begin with, and what quite a number of biologists argue is that the animals that we ended up domesticating basically chose domestication. They realized that hanging around us and wolves becoming dogs is the classic example, was it was possible to create an easier life with fewer risks of starvation or of injury. And so animals like gray wolves, at least one point and maybe more in their history, there were certain populations of them that decided that hanging out with us and, in effect, after a generation or two or three becoming domesticated was a good thing. Interestingly enough, coyotes have never seemed to do that. I mean, it's certainly possible for people to take a coyote pup and raise it up until the time it's about 10 or 11 or 12 months old. But in almost every instance, the animal responds the same way. And I'll tell you one story that the Wildlife Services people told me that is a good illustration. They had a graduate student attempt to raise a coyote pup as a domesticated pet in one of their enclosures a few years ago. And when that animal got to be about 10 or 11 months old, it was a male, it decided that its overseer, its human companion, was an unsatisfactory alpha and immediately began turning on that human every time it entered the pen, so that within about 2 days, they had to stop the experiment because it had become dangerous.
And so, retire the coyote.
Yeah, it had become dangerous. Mm-hmm. The coyote was attacking the human, this human that had raised it. So, in effect, it seems that coyotes have figured out they can circulate among us, they can live among us, they can move into our cities and be in our backyards and almost underfoot and derive all the benefits of a kind of domestication without actually having to be domesticated.
Pretty wily indeed. Another call here from Connie in Eugene. Connie, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good program. One of the things I always like to bring up when people bring up wolves and coyotes is the enormous damage done by not necessarily feral dogs, but domestic dogs to livestock populations, and also both small and large livestock populations. People don't like to hear about this, but as a person who used to know people who were farmers, you know, I've come across a field of 10 to 15 sheep with their throats ripped out by domestic dogs, and that was a big eye-opener to me. And then I asked the farmers, I said, yes, they said their major concern was not the coyotes, but the actual domestic dog threat. So I just wonder how often the figures are skewed, or people's legends or other things are skewed by domestic dogs instead.
Thank you, Connie. That's a great question.
Yeah, that's a great point to make. And we think, I discussed this in one of the chapters in Coyote America, that some of the depredations that led to the sort of death sentence for gray wolves and for coyotes as well in the 1920s and 1930s, actually, on closer examination by some of the biologists for the Society of Mammalogists, they turned out to be feral dog kills rather than kills by wild predators. But people just sort of glossed that over, in effect. They kind of ignored it. But, you know, there's a lot of concern among some groups of people about coyotes living in cities now and biting people. When the actual incidence of bites is like, well, there was a study in Canada a few years ago that indicated over a five-year period, about 8 people had been bitten by coyotes and nearly 300,000 people had been bitten by dogs in the same period. And yet there was, of course, no concern or outcry over that. The concern was over the 8 people who had been bitten by coyotes.
Right, almost a fear of wildness. You write in your book of one known death associated, a human adult death associated with coyotes in all of North American history. Certainly a much higher number associated with dogs. What about the hybridization between, we've talked about wolves, coyotes, and dogs, their relationship to each other? Do those three species, are they able to hybridize, and what are the results?
Well, they're able to hybridize. Coyotes can hybridize and do with remnant southern red and eastern wolves and with dogs. Interestingly enough, they do not hybridize, coyotes do not hybridize at all with western gray wolves. Mm-hmm. Even at the point when western gray wolves were down to a few straggling remnants and were looking for mates, they found mates among domestic dogs rather than the wild coyotes that were around them. But And there's an evolutionary reason for that. I argue that coyotes, red wolves, and eastern wolves are all out of a North American clade of animals that basically never left the continent and so didn't separate into separate species until about a million years ago. So when they encounter one another now, they recognize one another, and there are no barriers to their interbreeding, and so they readily do so. That's created a population of animals in the south and east now, as well as in Canada, that are often called coy wolves, that preserve about 60 to 70% coyote genetics, about 20% wolf genetics, and usually what remains comes from domestic dogs. So it's really a new animal that's emerging, started in the late 20th century and is becoming, in the 21st century, I think probably the species of wild canid that's going to be characteristic of the whole East.
The coyote is certainly a master of reinvention. Our guest is Dan Flores. He's the author of a new book called Coyote America. Dan, we are on our way out of this interview, but I want to ask, do you think America will ever make peace with coyotes again?
Well, I hope we do. I think what the coyote would have experienced here is 15,000 years of benign coexistence with humans, with native people. And then a whirlwind, they sort of reaped the whirlwind of our wrath and our misunderstanding for about 150 years. And I think at this point, maybe we're reaching a stage where we're environmentally and ecologically savvy enough that we began to appreciate what these native, ancient, small wolves actually offer us.
Thanks for being our guest today, Dan Flores.
You bet. I enjoyed it.